The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. This is a great week if you are a fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Deadpool and Wolverine has opened to good reviews and huge box office, and there's also a lot of news coming out of San Diego Comic-Con, and our chief film critic, Stephen Garrett, will be along to talk to me about developments in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which was supposed to be done, but now looks like it's coming back stronger than ever. But first, we're going to talk about books. We are Book and Film Globe, after all. We do love books, and we review books, and we talk about books as often as possible. Our critic, Dan Friedman, has written reviews of a couple of new sci-fi and fantasy books. One is a retelling of the King Arthur myth called The Bright Sword, which is quite good. It's by Lev Grossman, who wrote the Magician series, and Dan and I are going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about The Book of Elsewhere, which is a novel co-written by China Mieville and Keanu Reeves. Yes, that Keanu Reeves, you heard me right. And it is a book about an immortal super soldier. Dan and I will offer our critical assessments of both these books after this musical interlude. Dan Friedman writes book reviews for us, mostly about science fiction and fantasy books, which is an important, these are important genres to cover because, well, A, they have a lot of readers, and also these are the kinds of books that get turned into movies and streaming TV shows. And in the last week or so, Dan has reviewed two books that seem pretty likely candidates to be turned into movies and or streaming TV shows. And he's here today to talk to me about them. Hello, Dan.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going fine. It's fine.
Don't oversell it, Neil. Don't oversell it.
Look, I have my problems. we all have our burdens to bear. Although not as many burdens to bear as the protagonists of the two books you reviewed for us recently. So let's talk about there's two. So we've got The Bright Sword by Lev Grossman and The Book of Elsewhere by Keanu Reeves and China Mieville, is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's pretty forgiving on how to pronounce it, but I think it is Mieville, yeah.
Mieville. So these are two big books for the summer, basically. And we'll talk about them a bit by bit. Now, you've actually read and reviewed the entire books, whereas I picked them up, as we're talking, I picked them up at the bookstore yesterday and read the first 30 or 40 pages of each, so I can at least get a vibe off of them. And I will say that I'm more likely to continue reading one than the other. And we'll start with that one, The Bright Sword by Lev Grossman, who is best known as the author of the Magicians trilogy, which was turned into a fairly successful five-season sci-fi series. And you've been following Lev Grossman's career since he was writing Star Trek fan fiction.
Yeah, no, I was at grad school with Lev, and we were quite friendly. And he wrote a book called Warp, which was essentially that was his first novel, and it was essentially Star Trek fan fiction. Although it was a little bit different, but it was quite good. Anyway, so we've mostly lost touch, but both knowing the author a little bit, and also the subject is, you know, it's a retelling of the Arthurian epic and myth, and it's, you know, as an Englishman, that's something that you grow up with, and it's quite an undertaking for an author to do and for a reviewer to look at. And I'll try not to spoil anything. I think that Lev's done a really interesting and really good and well-researched book about this. And I'm happy that you would think about carry on reading. Just, you know, someone who's read The Magicians or seen The Magicians would not be surprised with the tone of this book. But I think, and I haven't read what Arthurian scholars would say about this, but or have said about this, but I suspect that they would be like okay with the factuality of it as far as it goes. I mean, it's a myth. So
King Arthur is a myth. There was no lady in the lake. There was no such thing as wizards.
You have to be careful, Neil. People will get upset.
They can get upset all they want. You know, the thing is, like you mentioned that as an Englishman, but you know, as an American too, we read The Once and Future King in school, and everyone saw Monty Python and the Holy Grail, you know, which Grossman quotes, right? That literally is the quote to book one. So it's not like he's unaware of his antecedents. And when you mentioned the tone, you know, I only read the first 40 pages before falling off to dreamland last night. But, you know, the tone, I think, while there's definitely, there's a lot of drama in the book, there's some irony and there's some humor. There's a little bit of winking to modern audiences. It's not written like, you know, something high and mighty. You know, it's an adventure story, essentially, at least from what I gathered from the first 40 pages. Your main character, his name is Colum.
Yeah.
He's a basically an orphan from the Isle of Mull who makes his way down to Camelot to become a knight of the Round Table. And that's tonight's chapter, but I'm assuming, you know, he's going to find that all is not well in Camelot.
Yeah, no, obviously, yeah. So all is not well. He's doing this sort of after most of the Arthurian myth has taken place, although he doesn't know that that's the case. And, you know, I think that's important, as you point out, that it comes from an outsider perspective. Like this is, he has heard of the myth and is coming in a sort of a contemporary way, and he's coming into it to join it, because like who wouldn't want to be, you know, if you're good at nothing except fighting and you know that the king of the large country to your south is this mythic, you know, legendary fighter, even then, like you're going to go and join them. And so it's a journey of discovery and partly of Colum, who is interesting himself, but really a chance for Grossman through Colum to tell an outsider tale of King Arthur and the Round Table. And also kind of fascinatingly, he does what some of the previous retellings of the myth have done, which is to delve into the different knights and their backstories. And he does it in a way which is appropriate for 21st century winky, I know, millennial, Gen X, Gen Z audiences, and maybe even some boomers, but which is also like in keeping in certain ways with the historical myths that have been told.
Right. So I guess my question is, so then without giving anything away, do people then tell Colum the stories of Lancelot and, you know, Gawain and Arthur and Guinevere? Are these actual characters in the book, or is this literally like after the fall?
Yeah, so interestingly, some of the stories he becomes aware of and he gets told, and they are stories of not so much of Lancelot. I mean, you hear the story of Lancelot and Gawain. Actually, Lancelot's important in this story, and so you do find out a lot of his story. But he's not one of the interesting characters. I mean, he becomes important but not interesting. And what's really interesting is the six or seven knights of the Round Table who are at Camelot when Colum gets there. And they're not necessarily super famous. You know, these people turn
not brave,
up.
Not brave, brave Sir Robin.
It's not brave, brave Sir Robin. But I was just impressed. I mean, somewhere in the afterword, it says that he's been working on it for 10 years. And, you know, sometimes authors say that and it means, oh, I had this idea 10 years ago and didn't do anything for 8 years. But it really does feel like, you know, there's texture to it. And you know, it feels like his, I wouldn't say snark, but the breeziness, the winkiness is earned in a way. And also earned through length. I don't know how, I have an electronic version of the book, so I haven't had to heft it around. If you went to a bookshop, you maybe have a sense of how bricky this is.
Yeah, it's like almost 700 pages and $35 in hardback, I might add. So
good value.
Yeah. Well, I will say, you know, I can put a book down no problem these days. And I found myself very drawn in to the character of Colum and to the story and to the writing style. I have to admit, you know, it was impressive to me. And I liked what Grossman was putting down. And I think this book's going to be a big success as books go.
Yep.
And I think that it's almost certain to be adapted into something.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. It kind of makes sense. And also with his track record with the magicians, I would also say that he's paid attention to the plot and to plot building. And so that things that take place, they pay off. Yeah, you know, things come back, things circle around. He's been thoughtful about what he foreshadows and what he puts in early, and it comes back around.
All right, so The Bright Sword by Lev Grossman, I would say we recommend it without too much hesitation. I'm not going to say the same thing about The Book of Elsewhere, which is, you know, the debut novel, so to speak, from Keanu Reeves. And really, Keanu Reeves is not a writer. I know he wrote these comic books that The Book of Elsewhere is based on. This has really got the stamp of China Mieville all over it. I got to say, before we talk about the book, you know, I had never encountered the work of China Mieville before. It's obviously a name that I'd seen. So I was like, well, China Mieville, it could be a female author. It could be a Jamaican fellow. You know, it could be, I didn't know what he looked like. And then I looked at a picture of him. He's like bald. And he's got all these tats. And I'm like, he looks like Joe Rogan. And I'm like, wow, this is not what I expected to see, you know, when I thought of a China Mieville. So I know that's very, very superficial, but I'm like, wow, that is a brick of a man.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that he's been around for quite a while now, and he has surprisingly changed extremely little. So he looked like an intellectual communist Joe Rogan before Joe Rogan looked like that.
Yeah.
There's an interesting article by a woman called Hannah Zevin, who went to go and see him and just to really get a sense of what he's been doing. And this interview came out last year, so it was... She did the interview before he could announce that it was with Keanu Reeves, and so it's kind of a fascinating thing. But what's happened in the last 8 years since his novel is that he hit some form of depression, and this is him coming out of it. He's got remarried or married. I don't know whether he was married before, and he's working on his magnum opus. This is not that.
Yeah. Well, this is an adaptation of a comic book series that Keanu Reeves did. Called the Berserk series, basically. I don't know, B-Z-Z-R.
I think Berserker. It's got an R on the end. So yeah,
Berserker. And it basically is about an immortal super soldier who has been alive pretty much since the dawn of human civilization. And he can die, but then he comes back to life, which is a fine concept that was well covered in the Highlander movies.
Exactly. It's an understandable concept that's been done.
Yeah. And, you know, that's fine. That's all fine and good. And it's certainly something that you could see Keanu Reeves starring in the film, which I'm sure, you know, I couldn't see the main character whose name was named Ubuntu. Whatever his name is.
Unute. I don't think we're given any real clues as to how it's pronounced. But and he's, as an American asset, he's known as B.
As B. And so, yeah, I just looked at him. I just was like imagining Keanu Reeves basically as John Wick as the character, because that's what he is. And, you know, that's all fine and good. My problem with the book, Dan, is that, like, I felt like, first of all, I read 30 pages last night, and it jumped back and forth in time 5 times. Different narrative styles, transcriptions of things, and then, you know, and it was a lot.
No, it's really interesting that, you know, we started off the podcast talking about heavy lifts, and then we proceeded to talk about how heavy Lev's book is physically. So I think that when Mieville's given this, you know, gets the call from Keanu Reeves and his agent says, you can't pass this up. It feels like a no-brainer on the one hand. You know, Keanu's done this comic series. As you explained, the conceit of it is pretty clear. Can you make this a compelling epic novel of the deep ennui of this 80,000-year-old soldier? And you can see why that would be compelling and interesting and like a guaranteed hit. But it's a heavy lift. It's really hard.
Right?
It's like, here's the Vietnam War. Can you make me Apocalypse Now?
Well, yeah. And, you know, and unlike The Bright Sword, this book is not long. I don't know if you read it digitally or not, but that's of the 3 books I bought yesterday. There was one I bought that we're not talking about. You know, it's the slimmest volume. And it just, you know, 30 pages of this compared to 40 pages of The Bright Sword. It's no comparison. The Bright Sword was a breezy, fun, yep, absorbing read, and this felt like I was watching you know, like a bad action movie in a bus station.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, I went, you know, I read the whole book and it felt, I did it in electronic form. So it's one of the occupational hazards of reviewing speculative fiction that you don't really want to be carrying them all around with you because they do tend to break your back. And this was, I think, about 350 pages, though. And, you know, and it did read longer. And I think that Mayville just thought this is an opportunity to get stuck in. And he got very philosophical and he wanted to get dug into certain history and to really, I think overcompensate for the vapidness of Reeves's comic series. I mean, the comic series has more muscles than plot and more blood than either.
Yeah, I would say there is, you know, it's a lot. Let's put it this way. You know, there's like a scene early on where Unut, whatever his name is, as a boy, you know, he's with his mother, and just the way it's written, you know, like there's a page break for no reason. And I thought, well, is this a new chapter? And then I have to hop over and I'm like, oh no, it's still the same dialogue, but there was a, you know, page and a half break for some reason. And, you know, it's just, there was like a lot of writing trickery in it. And I know that that is something that happens in genre writing sometimes, but I don't know. It was early in the book and it didn't really feel very earned to me.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that to some extent, Mayville really enjoys what he does. And normally there's a playfulness. And I felt like that kind of got lost. I don't know whether that's because of where he is in his life or whether because, you know, for Reeves, this is all deadly serious. So when you have a conversation about it, there's just an earnestness. And that's something that's, even in Bill and Ted, you know, that Keanu Reeves is a little bit more serious about it than seems likely to be.
It's just a lot. This book is like, sounds like a lot of John Wick saying, I need a gun.
Exactly.
I've got a gun. Like, yeah, we know you've got a gun. Okay, we know you're in a, you know, oh, the pain, it hurts. The pain hurts so much.
Exactly. I think there's a lot of, you know, that grumbling, the pain hurts so much. I've seen so many things, you know, and there's, it's like, there is a sense that there's some, in Blade Runner, you have Rutger Hauer's, you know, my eyes have seen the clouds and Orion or whatever it is. And it's really one and his sadness or melancholy is right at the end of his life anyway. We know that he's, you know, right. It's the death, the final scene.
Right, whereas the Book of Elsewhere is that tone from page one.
exactly. And I think, you know, and I think it's from that one. And I think that Mieville's really trying to, like, explain that and then philosophize. And there's a lot of Freudian psychology behind it and a lot of real deployment of cultural tropes to do that. And it's like, in the end, maybe, you know, so I'd said before, you know, here's the Vietnam War, can you make me Apocalypse Now?
And I just feel like a book about an immortal super soldier should be a little more fun to read. Like, right. This is not really a knock on Mieville as a writer. Obviously, you know, he's a very skilled, you know, novelist who, you know, who can craft a sentence. And, you know, it's not like the scenes weren't vivid or anything. It was just very heavy.
Yeah.
And especially compared with the other book that you reviewed for us, it's just, the difference couldn't be starker, really.
It's true. And I think, yeah, so on the one hand, he could have had a little bit more fun with it. And on the other hand, is the squeeze worth the juice, or is the juice worth the squeeze, right? Like, in the end, is this immortal actually a way of exploring our relationship to history and to our parents? Like, you know, is, like, definitely Unut has the physical strength to carry a lot of human history, but does he have actually the intellectual, like, wherewithal? You know, does he actually stand for enough to make it interesting?
I don't know. I feel like if this were me, I would probably have had a little bit more fun with my life. But that's just me. I like to party, so, or at least I did once upon a time. Well, in any case, these were both interesting worlds for me to tap into, and I try to read and see everything that we talk about. I don't know. I think the Book of Elsewhere might be headed to the used bookstore in my next batch of recycling. But The Bright Sword, you know, that's going to hang around. I'm going to finish it, and my wife's going to probably read it and enjoy it. And I think we might find a place for it on the shelf.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Put it next to The Once and Future King.
Yeah, call this the twice in future king. All right, Dan Friedman, thank you so much, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Neil.
Your little cinematic universe is about to change forever.
Logan,
are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Deadpool and Wolverine.
Team,
shake on it.
Go, 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 go.
Come on, girl!
Yes, let this man cook.
Get your special sock out, nerds.
God, I love this part.
Wait!
In another universe, another version of the multiverse, Stephen Garrett is the editor of this website, and I am the movie critic. In fact, there's a universe out there where Book and Film Globe is actually edited by a dog.
Oh, I like that. Your dog. Neil, is it your dog?
Possibly, or his name is Neil Doglick or something like that. I don't know. But we are in this universe. We exist on Earth 616. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe.
The sacred timeline.
The sacred time. In the sacred timeline, I'm the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. Stephen Garrett is our lead movie critic. And if you haven't already...
The sacred critic.
Sure, we'll call you the sacred critic from now on. And, you know, any other versions of you, sort of the female Stephanie Garrett from Earth 617. Stéphane Garret the French critic from Earth 1005, and so there's a version of you that's a pig, and there's a
set, but a film noir version of me too.
There's a film noir Stephen Garrett, of course. Is there
an anime, a Japanese anime version of me?
Yes, there's a version of you that's a car. Okay, we can go on. if you haven't already guessed, our movie of the week is Deadpool and Wolverine, which has pretty much snuffed out any of the snarky people who were saying that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is dead.
I would say, does it really snuff it out, or does it just justify what they're saying, that this is skullfuckery of a movie, where it's really desecration? Like, let's literally dig up our dead movie characters and just play with their bones.
I don't know. What I do know is that it's made a ton of money this weekend.
People
like it. So that's a sign that it's not dead. I just find it very funny. There's like, if you look at the gap is wider than usual for critics and fans on Rotten Tomatoes. The fans are like at 98%, 99%, which is the true sign of how a movie's actually doing. The critics, I mean, look, there are some people like you and me who enjoy Deadpool and Wolverine. I enjoyed it quite a bit, but there are a lot of people on there who are like, this is the end. This is the bottom of the barrel. This is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I saw someone refer to it as a slog.
Oh.
And you could say a lot of things about this movie, but it's not a slog. It's barely 2 hours long, and there's like a lot, there's action and jokes in pretty much every frame. So I find it amusing that this is not the movie to talk about the end of Marvel, because to me, this is actually the movie that has a sort of shot a jolt of energy back into Marvel, which, you know, let's to be fair, had a pretty bad run there with some of its latest movies, and a run that Deadpool and Wolverine references several times.
Right.
You know, it's fully aware. And that's the whole point of Deadpool, both in the comics and in the films, is, you know, he's a sort of fourth wall breaking, shit talking anti-hero who allows us all to make fun of our obsession with these costumed super freaks. which have taken over blockbuster cinema.
Okay, but you know, I think you definitely have a point about that. But at the same time, I also kind of feel like this is a palate cleanser of a movie. This is a sort of liminal movie between, you know, the Avengers mic drop that led to, you know, that the two part whatever it is 8 hour long thing that dropped in 2018, 2019.
Marvel has not been able to recover
except with fan service movies like the Spider-Man movies, where they're like, let's bring back multiverse Spider-Man and let's show all three at the same time. This is the same thing, right? Isn't it? Like, let's bring back Wolverine one more time. I don't see how this advances anything. I think this is spinning wheels, and I think it's just, you know, it's a bit of a circle jerk, right? I mean, even Deadpool would call it.
Yes, literally. you're right. It advances nothing, but it is a lot of fun. And
so much fun. So much fun.
It is a lot of fun. And, you know, let's be clear. You know, Hugh Jackman, as Wolverine, pretty much cements his legacy as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, superhero performance ever. I mean, he is incredibly good in this. He's funny, but he has some sort of, you know, he's Wolverine, so he's got to have some brooding drama.
And there's even a little, there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of pathos. Like, I don't buy the Deadpool pathos. Like, to me,
no, it's always been fake.
There's always pathos with Deadpool, but I don't buy it. But the Wolverine pathos is real because there's so much tragedy with the X-Men.
Yeah, at the same time, though, you know, like they trump up the pathos with this yellow, let me call him Yellow Wolverine, right? Because it's all off screen. He's like, he's haunted by the fact he describes what I guess happened. Would he just go berserk? On every or berserker and just like kill everybody in sight.
I suppose they didn't show it,
right? But we don't actually see it, so we have no idea what his pathos is. So it's not like the previous films. I think it was a little more tactile. Like you got a real sense of tragedy in this guy's.
No,
this is all.
This
like,
is a comedy. This is a superhero comedy. I mean, there's like a 5-minute fight between Deadpool and Wolverine where they don't leave the boundaries of a single Honda Odyssey. They're just stabbing each other to death because neither of them can die. So they're just stabbing each other in this Honda Odyssey.
So here's a question, because you are much more steeped in Marvel.
Yes.
And much more invested than I. I feel like I'm Marvel agnostic. I enjoy it, but I could go with it, go without it. Do you need to know anything about Marvel in order to enjoy this? Clearly, you need to know the deep cut stuff in order to really enjoy it. But average person off the street, I'm just curious, what do you think?
I think that if you have not seen Loki on Disney Plus, you're going to be very confused by the Time Variance Authority, which is the MacGuffin that drives the entire plot of the movie. So yes, in that sense, I think if you were just an average, I remember one time I went to see a MCU movie. And there was a reference to Cap, you know, Captain America. And some guy was obviously there with his family, older guy. And he's like, who's Cap?
Oh, wow.
You know? So there are people coming in off the street who you probably haven't seen Loki. And to me, you need to know the concept of these timelines in order to do that. And also, there's a lot of cameos. Some are more than cameos, special guest stars. And if you're not familiar with the movies or the TV shows that they come from, you're going to not enjoy their appearances as much. I'm not going to give any away, but there are some really good ones. And there's one really good one, big surprise that comes kind of early in the movie that had the crowd just cheering in the theater.
Is this the one that comes after the line that says, this world looks a little Mad Maxy?
Yes. Yeah. There are some great Mad Max jokes too. You know, and then there's just a bunch of stuff in the movie that I think it would really help if you were familiar with the universe. You know, if you're familiar with the X-Men lore, I mean, you really, you know, the thing is, like, obviously there are lots of people who are, because this movie made, I don't know how much money, a ton of money. And, you know,
estimated $205 million domestic, which is insane.
God, that's
especially
a lot of money.
For an R-rated movie.
It's hard. This is a hard R. There's a joke about, you know, getting a blowjob from a Boy Scout master, for God's sake, in a Disney movie.
I mean, that's my problem. That's, and you know, I put it in this at the end where I was snarky about that comment. But I really do feel like I don't want my Disney making movies like Deadpool and Wolverine. I was fine with Fox making it, but I don't think Disney should be really doing this kind of stuff.
There were kids. I mean, I was in my screening, you know, 10, 11 year, 12 year old kids. And I was like, I would be almost embarrassed to take my 21 year old son to this, you know, but I mean, for God's sake, these kids, I mean, there was stuff that was just not the violence. The violence was very violent too. There's a lot of violence.
I have problems with that too. At a certain point, it's just complete. It's just, you're just punching a pumpkin for the most part. It's viscera and it's numbing. It shocks at first and then it numbs you. But is that how you really want to react when you see violence? Like, there's no meaning to it. It's just it's a gag, right?
It's a gag. It's a comic book.
Yeah.
Let's not be Michael Medved and Jeffrey Lyons here.
This is what's ruining our country. No, but I mean, it's a little sad. It's a little depressing when I think, like,
it is.
Oh, yeah, kids are watching.
It is. And also, you know, for my critiques of the movie, I felt like, you know, for all of the guest stars and the hullabaloo, it was a little cheap. I mean, the sets were, you know, that New York City set, that subway set that they were on at the end. I mean, that thing was like backlot garbage.
Yeah.
You know, the
also
Voyager.
Also, it was 24th Street. 24th Street doesn't have a subway stop. I'm sorry. Come on. That's easy.
Right. Well, who knows what Earth, maybe on some other alternate version of the timeline.
Oh, there you go. That's a good point. That's right.
You could have it. You could,
we there are in some the there, timeline.
In some timeline, there may be a 24th Street subway station.
And isn't that another wonderful thing about this movie, is that he literally calls out. He's like, this is tired. It's over. The multiverse. And hopefully we won't. I mean, I guess we will, but maybe not. Also, we will. I don't know.
We will. Well, we still have the Spider-Verse and the animated. We're not done. They can't be done ever done with the multiverse. Not once they've introduced it. But, you know, and I like the void that they go into. It's supposed to be this like blasted desert landscape. And then at one point, they're just driving through a forest.
It makes no sense. After getting a car in a cornfield, the void actually reminded me of the movie that was a huge flop, which was the Quantumania, where they went into the quantum world or whatever. And I was like, this is the void. It's just another nonsense world where weird stuff happens and weird people are floating in and out.
I see you have not read comic books in the last 30 years. It's literally the whole. That's literally what comic books are. And
okay,
there are no rules. But there are no rules.
I guess there are no rules, but as antecedents, the previous Deadpool movies were grounded in a type of reality and also did not ramp up the stakes automatically to the end of the sacred timeline instead of just like, my girlfriend might die or whatever. You know what I mean?
Well, because they weren't the MCU. The MCU is big. You know, it's big, it's melodramatic. And this movie both provided an example of an MCU movie and also kind of took the piss out of it at the same time.
Yeah, which is healthy.
Yeah, I thought it was healthy. I mean, whatever. You know, we both have some critiques of it, but it is clear that the public interest in these characters has not waned. And that if Marvel churns out even competent versions of the sagas that they've been giving us over the years, people are going to respond.
I think interest has not waned in the legacy characters with the original actors playing them.
Yes.
And also the previous actors who play them who pop up in cameos and special appearances.
Exactly. Speaking of legacy actors from Marvel, there's no bigger legacy actor than Robert Downey Jr., who was the Iron Man and was literally the actor and the performance and the character who launched the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And at San Diego Comic-Con last weekend, Marvel really surprised people, like was able to pull off an actual surprise by pulling the mask off of their new Doctor Doom, the big villain for the upcoming Avengers saga. And lo and behold, it was Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, big surprise. And also, I mean, first of all, there are precedents. I was thinking about that too, watching the second Deadpool movie and being like, oh yeah, I forgot that Thanos was also Cable, right? So it's not like it hasn't been done before where the same actor will play two different characters. I mean, this happened, you know, Fantastic Four, famously the Torch, you know, was Chris Evans, but that was way before.
It wasn't way before. It was a few years before.
But it wasn't a conscious choice. It wasn't a conscious choice.
No, but you know, anyone who's criticizing this is thinking that this is, you know, Marvel running out of ideas or experiencing creative bankruptcy, which maybe they are. They're barking up the wrong tree with this choice because, I mean, come on. Robert Downey Jr. is a great, he just won the Oscar for Oppenheimer.
He's an Oscar winner, Robert Downey Jr. He's also currently playing like, what, five different roles in the same
show? In The Sympathizer on HBO.
I mean, he is an actor, and so actors can act. And I think it is going to be really fun to see him play a villain. If he turns Victor Von Doom into a sassy, you know, quick-witted, you know, like
Billionaire playboy
villain, then I think we're in trouble, right? But I think if he really plays a different kind of, different from what he normally gets hired to do, right? Which is the sassy, quick-talking, fast-acting kind of know-it-all asshole.
Right. And, you know, we don't know a lot about what they're going to be offering, because Dr. Doom is going to appear in the Fantastic Four saga, right? And that's coming up. That was something they're sort of pimping out for next year. So we don't really know the context of, we don't know anything.
We don't know anything. Well, I think what we do know, too, is that this is the third time they've tried to make the Fantastic Four work. And like the first two times they tried it, they both failed, right? Josh Trank, famously, the last version.
Well, the last version was horrible. That last version with Miles Teller and Kate Mara was a disaster. I kind of have a soft spot in my heart for the Jessica Alba, Chris Evans, Michael Chiklis, Fantastic Four. They didn't take themselves too seriously. They were kind of fun.
Yeah.
You know, they're not horrible. It's actually the fourth time because there's also the Roger Corman Ashcan version. Yeah. Version of the Fantastic Four. And then like you mentioned that this is the Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom. This was sort of formative comic material for you. And that was when I was a kid, I subscribed to three comic books. I subscribed to Detective Comics. I subscribed to the Spider-Man comic, and the Fantastic Four came in the mail. every week. And that was in the 70s, and that was hardly the height of that mythology. So I think that if you're thinking that Marvel is on its way out and they're introducing Robert Downey Jr. as the new big bad and introducing the Fantastic Four, then you're going to be sorely disappointed for the next 10 years.
I hope you're right. But the thing is,
oh, too, I'm definitely right.
That's right. Definitely right. I'm stating the obvious. I apologize for that. But Fantastic Four, personal favorite of mine. That was a comic book I really got behind and really loved. And I loved Dr. Doom as a character when I was a kid. And I didn't understand the big brouhaha over people like Iron Man. I was like, whatever. So like when Iron Man took off and that came out, I was like, why are people so into this? So I agree with you. I have high hopes for this. But I guess what I'm thinking is, this is a franchise that for whatever reason has not really taken off, and they've tried again and again. And I could see somebody like Kevin Feige being like, man, how can I hedge my bets here? How can I make sure that I at least get a big fat opening weekend? He can do two things to raise interest, right? First of all, get somebody like Robert Downey Jr. play Dr. Doom, which is a huge, wonderful idea. It's like a brilliant strategic thing from a producer's point of view. Also, he's bringing back the Russo brothers to direct this movie.
The Russo brothers are not directing Fantastic Four. They're directing the Avengers.
Movies. I'm so sorry. Oh, that's right. That's okay. So they're not involved. So who's directing Fantastic? Yeah, I'm conflating them because they were all on stage at the same time, weren't they?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't really matter because, you know, the movies, there's not a ton of personal stamp that can go on. Kevin Feige is the real director.
Okay, but isn't one of the Avengers movies called The Avengers Doomsday? So does that not connote that Dr. Doom is going
to be Dr. Doom will be the villain in it, but I'm saying it doesn't really matter. The Russo brothers, I mean, yes, can they make a competent, action movie with a large cast? Sure. But, it's not like he's hired, the ghost of Akira Kurosawa here,
No, but they are very good at balancing multiple characters, keeping it entertaining, keeping it light, keeping it heavy. I think that's not an easy task.
It's not an easy task. And yet a hack like Sean Levy somehow managed to not blow that. Sean Levy is not a great director. Come on. But somehow he managed to get us through Deadpool and Wolverine.
Yeah, that's true. That's because I think the previous was David Leitch, right? Who went on and did Fall Guy, who's I like him. He's a fun director. I mean, hats off, right, to Ryan Reynolds, who clearly has proven himself to be an incredibly astute, funny guy, knows how to write a script to keep things going and also do all the things that he's good at.
Well, it was written by a team, including the two writers who wrote the first two Deadpool movies. And they put the MCU in their hands and they didn't drop the ball, to their credit. I mean, Deadpool and Wolverine is in theaters now. If you are thinking of taking your 7-year-old to it, probably go see the Despicable Me 4 or Inside Out 2 or don't go to the movies at all. Go play mini golf. But if you've got a 17-year-old who's stoned and plays a lot of Counter-Strike Global Offensive or whatever, that'll be fine. I think you can safely take your 17-year-old to it. But don't take anyone who's never seen a Marvel movie before, because they'll be very confused.
But don't take your wife, basically. Did you take your wife to
the movie? Of course. First of all, I didn't take my wife. My wife and I went together. I'm not like, hey, honey, I'm taking you to the movies. All right, Stephen Garrett, editor of Book and Film Globe and a couple other timelines. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Stephen Garrett. Deadpool and Wolverine is on screens probably for the rest of the summer. And then it will be the filthiest thing on Disney Plus until the end of time. And look for other Marvel stuff coming out soon. You're not going to get rid of it. It's going to be with you for the rest of your life. It is your legacy. It is your destiny. You just can't escape. You can skip it, but it's going to be around. So if you're a cinema person who is snooty about the MCU, well, I understand why, but you're stuck with it. Also, thanks to Dan Friedman for talking to me about Lev Grossman's The Bright Sword and The Book of Elsewhere by China Mieville and Keanu Reeves. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We review books and film and streaming TV and talk about issues in the worlds of those industries as well. And we're here nearly every week with a fresh show for you to enjoy and for you to use for your pleasure or your whatever you use it for. We're happy to be here. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.